Number 2012-5106, Kellogg Brown and Root Services against the United States. Mr. Elder.
May it please the Court, John Elder with Kellogg Brown and Root Services. Years after receiving the full benefit of support services, the Army rated as excellent for the responsiveness and quality under extraordinary wartime circumstances, the Army refused to make good on the actual cost that KBR incurred paying its subcontractor, Tamimi Global, the cost of dining facilities at the Anaconda base in central Iraq during July to December 2004.
Mr. Elwood, in your opening brief, you say contractors are entitled to reimbursement absent arbitrary action or gross misconduct. But you also seem to agree that they're entitled to be reimbursed only for reasonable cost as defined in the FAR. Is there any binding law you can cite that justifies your definition of reasonable as, quote, absent arbitrary action or gross misconduct?
I think it's binding in this sense, because at the time that this regulation was adopted in 1960, there was already a well-developed body of law about what reasonableness meant. There's been, as we have argued, a consistent body of case law from the Board of Contract Appeals. The FAR Council has amended the regulation, and Congress has amended the regulation, not in a way that addresses this issue. And under the North Shore case, we cited to you in our Rule 28J letter, and as a CF to the Brownlee case we cited in our brief, we think that is evidence that that is what the regulation means. And, I mean, it is binding in that sense because it is evidence of what the regulation means. But no, we concede that there is no binding authority from the Supreme Court or even this court that specifically addresses the reasonableness standard. However, as I say, we have 50 years of case law beginning from before this regulation was adopted. There was, as I say, a well-developed body of case law at the time that's evident in things like the Walsh construction case from 1957. And reasonableness is a thread that runs throughout cost reimbursement contracting. And what that meant at the time the regulation was adopted and what the Boards of Contract Appeals have said ever since is that it means that contractors have discretion, and absent some abuse of that discretion, they will be made whole.
If the claims court was correct in applying its standard of reasonableness, everything fails for you, doesn't it?
If it was correct in applying
its standard of reasonableness. Well, let me put it another way. If all that there is findings of fact by the claims court, which we review for clear error,
right,
aren't you out?
There is one argument. There is one thing that we have argued is clear error. There is one finding we argue is clear error. But all of the arguments which we are arguing for are essentially legal findings. I do think, though, that apart from this whole issue of whether there is abuse of discretion, whether there is a kind of an enhanced standard there, I think that there are errors the court made. Like in this instance, the court concluded it did not give weight to the negotiation, the fact that this was reached by arm's length negotiations, because it thought that KBR's negotiator could have done a better job. And I don't think that is really wound up with the idea that you need to have an abuse of discretion. But as indicated by Professor Ralph Nash in his November newsletter, he's an unaffiliated expert who just wrote on this case because it's important. He is unaware of any case in 50 years where a court or a judge has applied such a searching standard to determining whether or not negotiations were correct. That you don't look at the fact that there was, they could have had more leverage or the negotiator could have done a better job. And if you look at the case laws interpreted by the Board of Contract Appeals, and this court said in T. Brown Construction versus Pena that you give great respect to the views of the Boards of Contract Appeals, that in Teledyne and the federal and the Court of Federal Claims in McDonnell Douglas, that it's essentially kind of a binary thing. When you look and you see, the FAR doesn't say whether they were vigorously conducted arm's length negotiations or competently conducted arm's length negotiations. It just says whether arm's length negotiations. It's a binary thing. And if you do have that, then you have then that is a factor that counts towards you. And when the judge applied this very, very exacting standard, which Professor Nash indicated was literally unprecedented that they do that and would have put, in his words, a huge burden on contractors to review arm's length negotiations that way, that was an error, regardless, I think, of whether or not you buy our argument that absent an abuse of discretion, the cost would be reasonable.
Mr. Mr. Eller, haven't you already been paid $25 million? And in this judgment, aren't you getting another $11?
I'm sorry?
Haven't you already been paid your client $25 million? And are you not being awarded $11
million? We were awarded $11 million, but my understanding is there's still about a $30 million gap between what we say we are owed and what the court below awarded us.
Have you been paid $25 million earlier?
I'm not sure.
That's what the claims court's opinion says.
The one thing is I do know that there's a shortfall my understanding is about $30 million. The second error, which I think the court made apart from this whole standard of review.
Let me ask you a question about this. Regarding common law fraud, suppose we hold that the government has shown a causal link between the fraud and the award of the Tamimi subcontract. Do you have any argument remaining if that causal link exists? I've got an obverse question on that for the government, so don't have a heart attack yet.
Yeah. You know, the thing is that is essentially I think the core of our argument is that there isn't a causal link, and that the court found that there was no evidence at all, or rather that the evidence indicated that it would have been the same regardless, both with respect to Work Release 3 or the Anaconda subcontract and the Master Agreement 3.
Mm-hmm.
The second overarching legal error that the court made was, although it agreed that you have to consider the circumstances of a decision and determine whether it was reasonable, it immediately added a caveat to that, which I think robbed it of any value, by saying that KBR would be subject to what it called kind of a conference from contracting, rather than considering the actual difficult wartime circumstances, unless KBR had no control over those circumstances. And we believe that was fundamentally mistaken, because it's contrary to the idea that you judge the reasonableness of a decision ex ante based on the facts that they face at the time. And if they make a decision that is reasonable at the time and it turns out not to have worked, that it can still be a reasonable decision. And in this case, the court didn't identify anything we did wrong on the self-performance. And it was the self-performance that she said rendered us weak and thus or rendered our negotiating position weak and thus undermined our ability to negotiate what she would have thought would be a more reasonable contract. The only thing she identified that went wrong was the fact that because of the rising tide of violence in Iraq, which the Army didn't anticipate, and I don't think we should be on the hook for it because of that, other countries wouldn't let their citizens come and work for KBR in performing. That was the only issue that the court identified. And if that is it, I don't think there can be any basis for saying that we were somehow at fault and you could say that we controlled that and that we should therefore be on the hook for that decision. And I think that's a very fundamental flaw. A government contractor couldn't proceed like that if you have, you know, people designing weapon systems and everybody thinks the stealth technology is going to work, but it doesn't work in the end. They shouldn't be on the hook for all those costs because they exercise some sort of control over them. That has never been the law, and I don't think it should be the law here.
I'm trying to understand how the audit fits in with this. Tamimi was paid by KBR as they went along. Is that right?
Yes, Tamimi was paid by KBR as we went along.
And were there any audits or interventions by the auditor of the Defense Department during?
Yes, there were audits along the way. There were audits for various other events. There was a settlement that occurred here covering the first part of KBR's contracting in Iraq and the first part of Tamimi's contracting in Iraq that was part of the DCAA settlement, which settled everything up to the June crisis, and we begin here with July.
Did they ever say that Tamimi should not be continued as a contractor?
No, they never did.
Overcharging?
No, they never said KBR, that Tamimi shouldn't be continued as a contractor. Tamimi was the government's favored contractor. The court below made a finding to that effect that the Army was quite fond of Tamimi. They contracted directly with them. They, at one point, considered contracting with Tamimi throughout Iraq.
I'm looking at the CFR defining reasonableness of cost. If it does not exceed that which would be incurred by a prudent person in the conduct of competitive business, and I see pages after pages, page after page, where the court analyzes Ms. Hayes' negotiation. It was not conducted reasonably. She wasn't knowledgeable. She wasn't informed. Why aren't those fact findings that we have to accept as not being clearly erroneous?
Because she applied the wrong standard. If you look again at what...
Well, the wrong standard, a prudent person in the conduct of competitive business, and so much of what the trial court says does not sound like the conduct of a prudent business person.
Two things. First of all, when it comes to arm's length negotiations, if you look at what Professor Nash said specifically about this case, an unaffiliated expert, he said that when it comes to arm's length negotiations...
We're reviewing the claims court decision, not Professor Nash's views.
But I mean, it's his understanding of what the law is in this area. And he says that it's essentially a binary decision.
What authority is that? I mean,
the Teledyne case, I mean, admittedly, it is not binding on this court, but the court has said we give it great respect. But there's like the Teledyne case from the Armed Services Board of Contract Appeals.
No, what McDonald authority is Professor Nash? I mean, yeah, he writes a newsletter.
Well, he has been practicing in this area for 50 years. This court has repeatedly cited him as authoritative. We cite a couple of examples in our reply brief. And the point is that when you just look to see whether there are arm's length negotiations, the FAR doesn't require you to go behind them. And in fact, Professor Nash and the case law says you don't. It's just
my recollection of what he said isn't that it was wrong. He said this is a problem.
He said he is unaware of any case. And I mean, he's been doing this for 50 years where anyone has ever looked behind and determined that the contractor could have done a better job. And if you look at all of the cases that cite this provision, they don't do that. They just look to see whether or not there was arm's length negotiation. FAR doesn't require more than that. Now, to return to this question about the prudent person standard, that is the language that was in there in 1960 when this regulation was first adopted. And it was interpreted at the time, it was interpreted before that time, as meaning that that we will not basically, because contractors, these are reserved, cost reimbursement contracts are reserved for situations where the risks are very great, the requirements are very difficult, and the profit margins are very thin. And because of that, and the government doesn't even dispute this, ordinarily they say most of the risk falls on the government. But all of the case law says virtually all risk falls on the government in these instances. And you simply can't have the contractors, when they're making so little money on these contracts, which are 1% and 2% contracts, when you're making
leaving
so little money
the
on
kickbacks
it,
and so on.
Those kickbacks were for the employee's own good. KBR didn't get any of that money, or we wouldn't be here. But there's they simply can't afford to then not be paid for things which they actually paid out for services that the government was more than happy with. Does this include my rebuttal time? I don't see my yellow light.
If it does.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, in that case, better reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
We'll save your rebuttal time. Let's hear from the government. Mr. Prouty.
May it please the court, and good morning. Everything that KBR has done to advance its case is premised upon a subcontract with Tamimi. Without that contract, there is no entitlement to payment upon the invoices, and it cannot establish its claim. But the court's factual findings demand a determination that subcontract was birthed in fraud and corruption. Envelopes full of...
Mr. Prouty, let me take you over to my my common law question.
Yes, Your Honor.
That I asked your opposing counsel. And it seems to me that what you're saying is that that given the claims court's finding of facts which could support a common law fraud finding, such as that KBR employees receive kickbacks, that they're receiving them played a significant role in the award of the Tamimi subcontract, including intervening with other KBR employees, that common law fraud shouldn't lie. And the court, indeed, that's your argument, and indeed the claims court makes those findings. But it seems that you don't dispute that the claims court's overall finding, which is that notwithstanding the fraud at issue, the contracts still would have been awarded to Tamimi. You or don't you? There's
well, I don't argue that the court's factual findings are not erroneous. Or I don't argue they're erroneous, I should say, clearly erroneous. What I do say, though, is that those factual findings, when she said, for example, there's no taint on the contract, were premised upon a misreading of the law. For example, is it possible that Tamimi might have gotten the contracts? We have always said that it's possible. We've always said that. In fact, the trial court quoted me.
But there's a lot in the record that says that the authorities, whoever they were overseeing all this, pressed Tamimi as a favored subcontractor.
The line of the record is that at some point, and it's based upon some testimony from Mr. Hall, some of the Army people talked about how they liked Tamimi. However, for example, Mr. Pecci, who was a subcontract administrator at KBR Hyatt, was going to give the contract at Camp Anaconda to TES, the event source, another contractor. In fact, he called him and said, you're on your way to Kirkuk for the C6 tasking. The C6 tasking has been moved to Anaconda. Drive to Anaconda instead. And when he did that, Terry Hall, recipient of thousands of dollars from Tamimi, stormed into his office and demanded that he change things. And he did so in a way that Mr. Pecci described as violent, and in a way that, frankly, he said he couldn't understand. But nevertheless, as Mr. Pecci testified, because what Mr. Hall wants, Mr. Gatlin wants, who's the head of operations in all of Iraq and Kuwait, and what Mr. Gatlin wants, you better give, he relented. That was the finding of the trial court. Now, the trial court's findings about it would have gone to Tamimi anyway were essentially the government hasn't proved it wouldn't have gone to Tamimi anyway. Because we can't. It's impossible to prove how the toothpaste would have gone out of the tube in a different direction. What we can say, though, is there's a causal link because the individuals who made the decision-making were corrupted. They were receiving money and other favors from Tamimi, and they were the ones that, one, in the first instance, found them technically acceptable to do work on the master agreement. Two, managed all the operations.
Do I hear you saying that because KBR didn't find their dishonest employees soon enough, therefore KBR has to absorb the cost of feeding the Army for all this period?
I'm saying that KBR is its employees. KBR is responsible for the actions. These are not just employees in the sense of a janitor or somebody feeding somebody. These were their managers who KBR gave responsibility for managing over $1 billion of DFAC contracts in Iraq. KBR is the one that tabbed the responsibility of these individuals. It said, Paul and Holmes, you are the top operational people for over $1 billion in contracting for feeding the troops in Iraq and Kuwait. You have this responsibility. You get to make all kinds of decisions about scope of work, about how it's making estimates about the costs, making technical determinations about who's qualified, the kinds of things that could steer contracts to the people. KBR put these individuals in that place. And the Supreme Court said in that process, it doesn't matter if they are technically officers of the corporation or not when it comes to kickbacks.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I hear you're saying that, yes, KBR has to bear the entire brunt of the cost of this contract, no matter what value may have been received, because they had dishonest employees.
Just as the Supreme Court said in Mississippi Valley, even if a company is ostensibly innocent of wrongdoing, even if it didn't know, if it has people there, the public interest, the good government interest, in having contracts that are free from corruption and are free from these things.
So KBR paid Tamimi. Shouldn't KBR at least receive the value of the goods that were provided?
Now, that is a question, of course, about whether or not quantum merit, for example, might be an offset or things of that nature on the common law fraud. Now, K&R Engineering says that it's basically void ab initio and you can't just reach back. I will admit there is, of course, some quantum valid arguments from Crocker back in 1916 from the Supreme Court that might argue otherwise. But the question about whether or not there's common law fraud and whether or not this contract was void ab initio, KBR selected these individuals and put them in a place of responsibility. Their boss, Mr. Gatlin, himself was getting alcohol, liquor from Tamimi, and was aware of at least some of the things going on with Mr. Hall and Mr. Holmes. Certainly knew that Tamimi was sending him off on a junket to the, I believe it was the UAE at that point. And it was just fine. KBR got very its head in the sand when these individuals were given responsibility by KBR. Again, the Supreme Court has made it very clear in acting process in the kickback context, made it very clear Mississippi Valley. This court made it very clear.
There's no dispute that these employees were dishonest.
Indeed.
That they received kickbacks, substantial
Indeed.
Kickbacks. But what I find troubling is now who is to, when there was value received, Tamimi's been paid. We're told overcharged.
Indeed.
And we accept that, even though, again, the record shows that there were a lot of other people who urged that they be in this position. Perhaps there was a shortage of local purveyors. But I don't see anywhere where it says that a good deal of what KBR paid to Mimi was not for the food which was served at Anaconda and anywhere else.
As a matter of minor factual correction here, actually the food itself was provided by the military. The people who actually cooked the food were the Tamimi employees. However, one thing of note is the DCAA audit, which kicked off this issue, found that Tamimi was essentially being paid approximately three times the average cost per person per meal.
But where was the DCAA? Where were the auditors throughout all of this? You wait until it's all over. The subcontractor's been paid, so there's no opportunity for any somehow equalization. And the entity that had the crooked employees for $20,000 or $30,000, now we're hitting for however million is left, about $30 million, I guess.
Your Honor, first of all, the touchstone for the case is not the amount that it took to corrupt KBR. KBR sold his virtue cheap. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that, therefore, the government, because it was only $38,000, should be bear the higher burden.
Mr. Prouty, am I correct in my understanding that the government is conceding that if KBR can show that certain amounts were paid out and were legitimate payments, that it's entitled to quantum merit?
I'm not saying that yet, Your Honor, and I don't want to be dodgy about this, but I'll say that it was never briefed below, and it was really not fully before the court. Crocker suggests with Qualcomm Valabat back in 1916, K&R suggests any payment upon a corrupted contract like this, you get all the money back. Their intentions. Certainly the government's position is that we should not have to pay any money on a corrupted contract. However, I will admit that there is some law that goes either way. For the purposes of what we have here today, determining whether there's common law fraud, certainly it's very clear that the circumstances meet that test.
If we found common law fraud and sent it back down and said, but you have to look at quantum merit, would the government's position be, no, they've waived that?
As far as waiver, no, Your Honor. I mean, I would say that there was a motion to dismiss on very clear grounds. And it was the quantum merit was not for the trial court. So we would not punish KBR, and certainly the trial court would not either, for failing to raise quantum merit at some point. Again, I would suggest the law is very clear. K&R Engineering says you don't use quantum merit. Amdahl from this court, although sort of having quantum merit at one point, suggested that for fraud cases, it's a different story. And there's certainly law, I think the balance of laws on the government side. But that has never been presented to the trial court. That's not presented here.
Mm-hmm.
What is presented here is individuals who had material roles in the contract award, both in finding that Tamimi was technically qualified contractor and in statement of work determinations, and in determinations of overriding Mr. Pitch's initial inclination.
Keeping them on the job.
Keeping them on the job.
So when they discovered the kickbacks, they fired the people.
No,
and yet you're still hitting them for the entire, everything that they paid out.
Not only are they were not fired for the kickbacks. The kickbacks were only discovered in 2009 when Mr. Hall was being prosecuted for another matter. And in December of that year, I believe it was, he divulged kickbacks to government prosecutors when they were seeking to have a plea bargain on a different matter.
So what does a contractor do? How do you discover that you may have fraudulent employees at the risk of the entire contract? I suppose what you get is a cash in advance and a whole bunch of other increased costs.
Well, Your Honor, there has always been a requirement for decades and decades and decades that contractors are responsible for who they hire. It's a hiring decision. If you hire somebody who does a very bad job in your contract and you get terminated for default, that is your fault because you hired people.
The corporation paid a penalty for these kickbacks to its employees, right?
Your Honor, it, as a result of the trial, the court found that it should get basically
$38,000,
Your Honor, yes. A very small penalty for the damage that was done.
But that was not, there was no fraud in the making of the contract, was there?
In the making of the Tamimi subcontract or the original log cap contract, Your Honor? The log cap contract, no. The Tamimi contract, totally fraudulent, because the individuals involved were taking kickbacks. And there would never have been, and it took Terry Hall saying it was okay for Tamimi to get the contract technically, for it to get a master agreement. He had veto power. Now, is it possible that they would have got it anyway? Certainly. But if we were in a bid protest and the head of the source selection evaluation board technically qualified people and he was on the end of a kickback, we would have no doubt and no problem kicking that back and saying, no, that is an invalid award. You get the exact same thing here. And a final thing, Your Honor, Judge Newman, you expressed a concern about what is a company to do. It should keep an eye on the costs. And if it sees that Tamimi is extraordinarily expensive compared to the other subcontractors, as there was evidence that the contractor...
There's something very strange. Here we have the Army saying, we want you to deal with Tamimi, even when there are other bidders on these contracts. Here we have situations that, according to some people, my money always seems to be changing hands as far as subcontractors are concerned. So now, eventually, it was discovered there was $38,000 in kickbacks to two employees. Therefore, we're not going to pay you the $40 million that you, we're not going to reimburse the $40 million that you paid to the subcontractor that we urged you to take, even though that subcontractor in wartime, with all of the consequences and the pressures perhaps to use local subcontractors in these circumstances, and I don't know what else, all of the things that are on the record that explain how we got to this situation. And nonetheless, the prime contractor who had a couple of dishonest employees is going to cost them $40 million because these employees got $38,000 in some kind of goods or services or vacations or the things that apparently was done with that money.
It was cash and envelopes for the most part, Your Honor. And beyond that, the $40 million was not withheld by the Army because of the kickbacks. The Army didn't know about the kickbacks at the time it withheld the $40 million.
Well, that's really hard to understand why it was withheld in all of the circumstances of this wartime situation in Iraq, the bidding, the pressures, the uncertainties, the dangers, that to say we're not going to compensate any of it.
The government did compensate KBR, Your Honor. The government compensated the amount that it found appropriate for that six-month period of time that was the subject of this lawsuit. It found that it was paying per person per day at the largest dive facility, which arguably should have been the cheapest one, almost triple what others were. And that was why the DCA withheld the money. When KBR challenged it in the court, they put out three bases for saying it was a reasonable cost.
Where was the Army and their auditors through all of this, where now we determine that they were charged too much because it was $23 a meal when it should have been something else?
Well, the auditors were working very, very hard. Obviously, it was a war zone as well. But the persons with the most – KBR had the responsibility under the law cap contract to keep its prices reasonable. It was KBR who had the first initial responsibility. It was KBR that recognized through the summer of 2004 prices were unreasonable.
Where were the auditors through all this? Say this is something that could very well have been discovered if there were cause on the ground at the time in light of all of the circumstances for saying that you're paying the subcontractor too much.
The auditors were questioning things, Your Honor, and just to be very clear, KBR questioned the cost itself. They knew there was a problem, and internally they recognized there was a problem, and that's why Vice President Walter, for example, said, we can't pay this because it's too much. The auditors were there, Your Honor. Now, the auditors did their more finished audit reports subsequently to the conclusion of the contract, basically because of the large backlog, and of course because they wanted to do it right, and because they wanted to examine the information that KBR provided to it after the fact. But they were there, Your Honor. And KBR knew itself, however, this money was way too much, and I see I've gone way over my time.
Any more questions? No questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Krause.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Elwood, this is full rebuttal time, please.
Mr. Prouty made a number of factual assertions which are, I think, inconsistent with the record. For starters, he kept mentioning this argument that government auditors said KBR paid triple for this facility what it paid elsewhere. The district court, rather the trial court, found that figure deficient. She says it discussed it on page JA76, and she found KBR's explanation more persuasive. There were facilities in there that weren't even operating in this time period. That is, the DCA auditors compared this facility to, I think, a list of like 12 facilities. And there were some on there that weren't even operating at the time. There were some on there that didn't have overhead costs that needed to be amortized, things like that. They found the government's, or rather KBR's example, to be more persuasive. Secondly, he argues that there was some sort of finding that Mr. Pesci changed his mind as a result of Mr. Hall's arguing. There was no such finding. You can look through the thing. You can look through the opinion. She found in no uncertain terms that the Hall and Holmes involvement had no effect on giving the master agreement or on the work release. On the master agreement, the only involvement or their only job was to say whether they were technically qualified. And everybody knew that they were technically qualified. They were already performing at this very airbase at the time. With respect to the causation, what he doesn't tell you is that Jim Spohr, who was the regional manager for KBR for the northern region of Iraq, he was the one who had the idea of switching the Kirkuk contract to, when it was switched from Kirkuk to Anaconda, that it be given to Mimi. It was his idea. And the judge below found that she credited testimony of Bill Jonas that it would have been irresponsible to give it to anybody else when KBR is ramping up to feed so many people in such a short period of time, and you have so many moving parts. You're feeding 200,000 people in an area the size of California. You can't be switching out people who are performing well already on that site, as Tamimi was at Anaconda, to do something else. I think it's very telling if you look at, you know, they talk about how important Hull was, but it's undisputed that the Kirkuk contract was given to the event source instead of Tamimi at a time when Hall was supposedly was getting kickbacks. That contract was given to the event source rather than Tamimi at Kirkuk, the one that was eventually switched to Anaconda. So that's one area already where Hall, you know, he actually recommended the event source there, not Tamimi at a time he was taking kickbacks. But secondly, there was another contract that was led at the time for a Baghdad base.
So what does the fact that he recommended that one?
Well,
me.
In any event,
other than that, he wasn't doing his full job.
Well,
for
that, true, but I mean, the fact of the matter is that at a time when Tamimi was supposed to be getting favored, the event source got that one. The second one at Baghdad, where Hall was advocated Tamimi, it went to the event source again. And at Camp Arab John, where Hall advocated certain action, they rejected it. So the court below found that he was a mid-level employee, and that it would have been irresponsible to give the Tamimi Anaconda subcontract to somebody else. And there's and Mr. Prouty has given you no reason in the record to second-guess the judge's findings in this score. She applied the Godley case conscientiously, and I don't think there's any basis for finding that it was clear error. In addition, he suggested that that Hall's supervisor was aware of the kickbacks going on, and the judge, the court below, explicitly found that there was no reason for him to believe that. He was unaware of the kickbacks that were going on, and that is in the opinion. One other thing that I think is noteworthy, when you were talking to Mr. Prouty about the DCAA auditors, the DCAA auditors, when all of this happened, KBR paid a settlement to basically true up things at the at all these air bases up until June 30th. And at the end of all that, the DCAA auditors found the rates which were being paid on June 30th to be reasonable. And those fee, if you look in the records, that is exactly the same amount that was being paid on July 1st, which is part of the beginning of the period that is being contested. So again, we have the attention of the DCAA auditors, and there's every indication that they thought that these rates were decent. Finally, I think one thing that is important to keep in mind is that there's no dispute that KBR had a zero-tolerance policy for kickbacks. Mr. Pecci was actually fired for soliciting a kickback. And so it's clear to everybody we took this very seriously and when we did everything we could about it. But what the government is arguing for here is that years after receiving really excellent services, that they can just because of two minor people where the court below has found no effect on the contracting, that they can go in and basically blow up literally hundreds of millions of dollars contract, and we would have to go back and negotiate for quantum merit at best. I think that that is an extremely hazardous position. I mean, it's hard to believe that the government would be able to contract well with military contractors when they face that kind of risk, not only on the cost reasonableness front, but on having contractors blow up when somebody who were found mid-level managers, that the court below found the effects of it incidental, that they could lose the benefit of literally, or rather they could lose and have to fend for hundreds of millions of dollars this far after the fact. It's just not a recipe for happy government contracting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood, and thank you, Mr. Prouty. The case is taken under submission.